Okay, you have 30 seconds to talk about Space
Stop
Jam.
It. I told
30
you.
30 seconds to talk about Space Jam.
I told
Space
you
Jam.
We weren't doing
Go.
It that way.
30
no.
seconds. That's
I
it.
Have things to unpack about Space Jam. So you're not going to do that thing where if I'm the only one who saw the movie, I get 30 seconds to talk about it because you've deemed it a film that isn't important. We're going to talk about Space Jam
Wait,
at length, even though you haven't seen it.
Shh, calm down. Relax.
Really?
Linoleum knife.
How many podcasts in the cinema, how many microaggressions are you going to kick the show off at? You're learning all the wrong lessons from physical. You're acting like the awful husband.
I'm sorry, but where's my coffee? Where's my coffee? Babe, coffee? More coffee, babe? This is not a show where we're talking about the television series Physical.
No.
That's happening on LKTV, a different
yes.
podcast.
Over at the
that's
Patreon.
On the Patreon. But Linoleum Knife, mm-hmm. that's this podcast.
It is.
You said it was a podcast of the cinema?
I did.
That's what it is.
You're Dave White. You're being very bad today. I'm Alonzo Duraldi, who puts up with you.
Am I being very bad? Or am I being really great?
Fuzzy line with you.
It's a thin line.
We're film critics. We're married. Welcome to the show.
This is, yeah, you were the film reviews editor for The Wrap. You host many other podcasts
yes,
like
so we
Maximum.
Talk about those later.
Maximum Film and or stuff not, like that.
So, yes.
Okay, sure. Talk about them later.
Fine.
I write reviews. I, for The Wrap, and you're the editor of them.
Yes.
When I write for them.
Yes.
Got a new one posting this week.
Yes.
For a film that we'll talk about
next time.
This next episode.
Yes.
I feel like I got myself back more into the swing of it.
Good.
I wrote a review for Undina, the German film by Christian Petzold.
Mm-hmm.
About 6 weeks ago now.
Your bolts were all rusty?
I felt really rusty. Like, I felt like, oh no.
Sentences.
Me no words. Yeah, and this time I feel like I did, competency.
All right.
Yeah.
It's good to have goals.
My goal each day is, like, do my physical therapy stretches.
Mm-hmm.
Put on some clothes, maybe. Wash a dish. Make some dinner, maybe. Stop crying.
Oh, stop. I'm the one who cried through the pandemic.
Who was more cryy in 2020? Was it you or me?
I think, on any given other year, I'd say it would be you.
It would, I'm more of the cry. People don't think that's true.
No.
I'm very sensitive.
Yes.
Yeah.
My usual thing was I cry at movies, but not in real life. But 2020,
you cried
I cried
real
in
life.
Real life.
Yeah.
A lot.
And I became, I guess the opposite. I became, It all felt like a crisis.
Well,
and so I was sort of like, all right, we're going to do things. We're going to get through this.
2020 for you was a task.
Right.
And you love to tackle a task.
I do like a task. It's true.
Yeah.
When there's no task, I start to feel all funny inside.
Which is another way of saying spin wildly out of control. How's your summer, everybody?
Mine is okay. Thank you for asking, husband. I I've been to social events mm-hmm. with friends, vaccinated friends, been to some movie theaters, not too scared about the Delta variant because the movie theaters I go to
tend to be empty ones.
Tend to be nearly empty.
Yes.
We've been eating in, like, how many restaurants have we been to? Half a dozen?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Most of them outside? A couple of them inside?
We've eaten inside a couple times.
We ate inside a couple times. The Guardian posted some weird thing today about how 60% of the hospitalizations in the UK mm-hmm. are from people who have been fully vaccinated.
Which and turned out to be not true.
Apparently, it was they made a mistake.
Oops.
They meant to say
typo
that it was unvaccinated people
yes.
in the hospital. And when I read it the first time, I was like, what? "I'm sorry, what? What's happening?"
Yeah.
And then the
yes,
you had to go down and read the comments. But people were like, "That's not no,
nope." Whereas in California,
so, you know,
everybody in the hospital is unvaccinated.
I'm still, you know, obviously, like any reasonable person, I'm scared of everything.
Yes.
But I'm still feeling good about my vaccination.
Yes, that part I have no regret about.
I mean, I don't want anyone touching me or coming near me or anything like that. And I'll be wearing my mask still everywhere I go because the California mask mandate.
Yes.
Is back.
It's back.
Although apparently they're not going to enforce it. This is all going to be...
Did they ever? I mean...
This is all going to be pretty wild. Bottom line, y'all, you're on your own, is what they're telling us.
Ay, ay, ay.
Again, still, after 50 years of being, you know, you're on your own.
Yes. Rugged individualism, everybody.
Yes.
Society is for chumps, apparently.
That's... Yes. We do have some films,
yes,
to discuss.
Yes,
some of them are, I think, significant,
mm-hmm.
important for our listeners to watch.
Yes,
others, no. Mm-hmm. And we will begin with the biggest no. And you have more than 30 seconds.
Thank
In
you.
Fact, stretch out. Relax. Take your time. Explain everything that you need to explain about Space Jam 2.
Yes.
You saw it
uh-huh.
at the premiere.
Yes.
I did not. Were you even allowed to bring me?
I was told in the email that I was not allowed to bring a plus one. And then upon arrival, I was asked, is your plus one with you?
Well.
And they had a whole second ticket pulled and everything.
I'll tell you something about that particular screening. They waited until, they took their sweet ass time telling you when it was even happening.
Yeah.
What time it was even happening.
Well, I knew what night. So
not good enough.
Yeah,
fact that they were disorganized about who could even show up.
A thing we have explained on the show before, and if you're relatively new, because this didn't happen at all in 2020, you might have missed it. If you don't have anything to do, even adjacently the way we do with the film industry, the prospect of a movie premiere seems really exciting. Like it's a prize in sweepstakes. It's a thing you see on TV and the Klieg lights and the red carpet.
Right.
It all seems very exciting.
Yeah, no, it's not. That's not what they are.
If you are a working critic who has to go to the premiere to review the movie, it is a giant pain in the ass.
It's good. Did you say it's good for the people who are in it?
Yeah,
if you're Chris Evans,
sure. Yeah, if you're a movie
I'm
star,
sure it's a pretty good time.
And you're being herded around, and like you know, I'm sure you know. Yes, you have to dress up for it, and you have to like
right.
make sure your face is all made up and your hair
right.
is perfect and all that stuff. But like you're being handled, and so you glide through the whole thing with a minimum of repercussion.
And if you're a film critic, you are also being handled.
Ooh.
you were being mishandled.
Yeah. If you're a film critic, you have to park in like sub-level three of LA Live.
Is that how far down you have to go? Yeah.
Attend a pre-party when it's for a children's film means that all the catering is of the corn dog school.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they weren't great corn dogs.
Was it a hot dog on a stick?
Yes. Oh, was it actual? I don't know.
See.
I don't know.
Like, don't talk. Don't talk.
Anyway.
Sadness about hot dog on a stick.
It was all very average. And then you get herded into
a theater. Did they have Uncrustables like at that time?
They did not have Uncrustables. Alas. And then you get herded into a theater in a seat you do not choose for yourself. And then you have to sit through half an hour of speeches where everybody talks about what an amazing opportunity this was and how much they love everybody they worked with.
So amazing.
And then like an hour or so late, the film starts. And then you have to exit from the third level of the parking Anyway, I know I'm not a janitor in a slaughterhouse. These are minor inconveniences compared to the workaday lives.
No. Listen. The secret of life is that all jobs are terrible.
Well, never more so for film critics than when we have to go to a premiere.
So don't apologize for the elements of your job that you dislike. Because they are meant, those things that you dislike are meant to throw you off your game and make you feel like you aren't nothing. And so, you have every right to say, no, this actually sucks. Treat me nicer, please.
Yeah, the junket press got to see it in a nice theater on the lot, you know.
But, yeah.
And yes, we do tell each other these things, publicists. So anyway, then I had to watch Space Jam: A New Legacy. And it's
well, I mean,
I was never a fan of the original Space Jam, which to some of you will sound like, you know, blasphemy. But sorry, it's not good. It's never been good. You were eight. And so now we're doing this all over again. And it's, I think, maybe worse.
Really?
Even though like LeBron James comes into this
is with, cool and is, we like
yes,
him.
Yes, yes, and he has more big screen experience than Michael Jordan had at the time because you know he had that great appearance in Trainwreck.
Right,
but it's just a big nothing of a movie, and its big ideas are terrible ones. Like the idea that we're going to set this inside of the servers at the Warner Brothers studio lot, so that the entire history of the IP is at our fingertips. Great. But then do something with it, apart from just having, you know, Catwoman and baby Jane Hudson cheering at a basketball game. Like, it's they you basically get these, the not even the theme park equivalent. They're almost the Hollywood Boulevard / Times Square cosplay equivalent of these characters.
When you say baby Jane Hudson.
Yes.
Is this an animated version?
No.
Or it's Betty Davis.
It is a background actress dressed and made up as baby Jane Hudson.
Oh.
In the same way
it's
that...
They didn't take a clip of Betty Davis and sort of morph
hologram
it into...
Hologram it.
Okay.
No. The All nun right. from the Devils is not played by Vanessa Redgrave. You know...
Oh, we're not getting Vanessa Redgrave's likeness?
No, just a woman in that habit, in that wimple, whatever.
Oliver Reed in the crowd with her?
Sadly, no.
She's sort of licking him.
Just the one nun.
Well, then that ain't the Devils, is it?
You know, like, you know, and the Animaniacs and the Flintstones and Scooby-Doo and Jabberjaw and, you know, but they're just there to cheer at a basketball game. Like, there's no anything with them. There's the only time they do any kind of sort of interactive, let's make a joke here, is at the beginning of the movie, LeBron James gets stuck in there for reasons that are too long to explain. He and Bugs Bunny have to go get all the tunes back together from all the different various corners of the Warnerverse.
Wait, what's that? What's a Warnerverse?
It's basically like you're inside the server. Each sort of IP has its own planet. So there's like the Harry Potter planet. There's the Casablanca planet. There's the Looney Tunes planet. So, you know, like when... And these are some spoilers and I don't care.
Was Magic Mike in it?
No.
Was there a Magic Mike planet?
Sadly, no. When you know you see like Ingrid Bergman say "Play it, Sam," and sitting at the piano is Yosemite Sam. You know, that
it, that I would have laughed at that.
That was funny. That would there's a big they go into the big chase from Mad Max Fury Road, and Wile E. Coyote is chasing the Roadrunner.
Okay.
Wile E. Coyote has sprayed chrome on his teeth. Like, okay. That lasts for about a minute. That's the one thing in this whole movie. The rest of it is this dumb basketball game and everybody in the stands cheering or booing or whatever. What bugs me so much about this, and I was thinking about this after seeing it, when I was a kid, I loved the idea of characters breaking out of their proscribed universe. You know, when Superman versus Spider-Man came out in the 70s, I was like 8 or 9 years old, thrilled to death. Like, the idea that these characters that would never cross paths are now actually going to be interacting and like fighting and talking to each other and all that stuff. A thing that we talked about once on LKTV, this Saturday morning thing done, I think it was the ABC's the Saturday Superstar movie or something. This thing called The Man Who Hated Laughter, where they put all these comic strip characters into a Saturday morning cartoon story. So you have like Blondie and like Snuffy Smith and, you know, High and Lois.
Snuffy Smith, the character that your grandparents...
No, he was still around when I was reading comics as a kid. Really? In the 70s, yeah.
I don't remember that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I grew up in the South. It was always in the paper.
All right.
You know, just so it's just like characters that would never normally bump up next to each other. Like, that's a fun idea. That's a cool concept. You could do neat stuff with it. But they don't do anything interesting with any of this stuff. It just lies there limply. It's ugly to look at. Once they get to the basketball game part, they transform the Looney Tunes into that textury, furry, feathery 3D version of themselves.
Okay.
Which is always yuck.
True.
It's less yuck than it was in that I Taw a Putty Tat short that came out about 10 years ago.
I have no memory of this.
It was attached to Happy Feet 2. And okay. it was a Sylvester and Tweety cartoon.
Yes.
And not only could you see like every individual hair on Sylvester's body, but like his drool was like these drops in the droplets. Like,
so,
you know,
Jonathan Groff.
Jonathan Groff, yes, exactly. In Hamilton. Yeah. So that was vile. And this is just like unsettling. But it's a 2 hour, not funny, not entertaining piece of not entertainment. And it's a waste of, you know, the talents that LeBron does have as a person on film and of these legendary characters.
Well, is there any moment or split second where there's the suggestion that incorporating all of these different, you know, copyrighted characters, characters owned by Time Warner,
yes,
etc., is the idea that cannibalizing your own intellectual property is a dead end?
No. This never makes any kind of comment upon itself in any way, which it certainly could have. And it could have. But yeah. Not that it had to, but it doesn't. And it doesn't just indulge in the... I mean, think about it. Think of the freedom to have, like, to run amok with you know, Warner Brothers, you know, established universe of characters through the prism of the Dadaism of the Looney Tunes that they're most, you know, unhinged.
Uh-huh.
And they don't take advantage of any of that.
The duck-a-mucking of it.
The duck-a-mucking of it, exactly. our friend Mark Koik has a very lengthy Twitter thread in which he posits that by putting the devils into this movie, it's not just a thing that's like, you know, oh, it's inappropriate for children, but that it's actually a way to revive interest in the film so that perhaps at some point Warner Brothers will actually, like, reissue it and, like, put it out on Blu-ray and, like, make Ken Russell's uncensored director's cut available. Because that's a movie that became a kind of a political hot potato.
It did.
In previous, you know, studio regimes, like, around the time of, like, when Cop Killer was controversial and right wingers were the
Body Count.
Body Count song.
Yeah.
When conservatives were going after Warner Brothers over that, like The Devils and A Clockwork Orange were the movies that they dredged up to be like, and
look what else they've done.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, because Ken Russell doesn't have the sort of untouchable patina of Kubrick, like Clockwork Orange has over time been made available in the UK where it was banned for a long time. It has been, you know, is treated like the serious piece of cinema that it is. The Devils has been a movie they've been very happy to like pretend never existed.
Is it patina or patina?
I don't know.
I always thought it was patina.
It's a word I've read, so I don't know. So if he's right, I hope he's right. I have no idea.
That would be nice. I would like to see The Devils in its unedited version.
Yeah.
I was able to see it at the now-gone CineFamily back in the day. Mm-hmm. I don't remember what version of it.
It was not the Ken Russell cut. That's been all but impossible to get for quite some time now. But it could.
But it exists.
It exists, and it could be restored, but no one's doing it.
Right. Someone will.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't see the point of this movie. Like, I don't think that kids are necessarily going to respond to it. And I don't understand the people who adore the first Space Jam. So maybe this is right in your sweet spot.
Well,
it's very Ready Player One, obviously, you know, in terms of like, let's just throw all these, like the poor Iron Giant, like they keep getting dragged out for nonsense like this and Ready Player One. It's like, how about we like, everybody go buy a Blu-ray of The Iron Giant. That movie probably still has never become profitable, but we've all decided we love it now, even though it tanked when it came out.
Right. It's so hard to say goodbye to yesterday.
Did you ever get around to seeing Ready Player One, by the way?
Yeah.
Okay, I couldn't remember. Ugh.
We talked about it on this podcast.
Yes, well, we do a lot here, right?
It's very bad.
It's
a very bad movie.
Yes.
The example I've brought up so many times over the past 10 years is that when I was 5 or 6 years old, my mother took me to the Civic Theater in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, mm-hmm. to see Santa and the Three Bears, an animated feature for children.
Yes.
For little children.
Yeah.
And I was a little children, and I loved it. Best movie I've ever seen. I was, again, maybe first grade,
right.
But maybe not even first grade. Saw it again when I was an adult. I was like, oh, Santa and the Three Bears. Loved that when I was 5 years old. I'm going to look at it again. Oh, my. Practically unwatchable.
It is.
I'm sure my mother sat through the whole thing hoping that she could just go get a cigarette.
Mm.
For all I know, she left me in the theater for 40 minutes while she smoked a cigarette out in the lobby.
One did that back then.
Yeah.
She didn't have to go outside to smoke. She just had it in the lobby.
Yeah. So... You
Mad
know,
Monster Party, is it fair to say? Is that one that didn't age well for you?
Mad Monster Party, still lots of fun to look at.
Sure.
Not a great film.
No.
But yeah, it's tough to... It's tough to become an adult and then look at something that you held really close to your heart and see it. As an adult, to see it with adult eyes and to look at it and think, oh, that was really bad. And I was just a child and children are dumb. So, there goes a garbage truck.
Yes.
Down our street. Hello, garbage truck. Thanks for...
Removing the existing prints of Santa and the Three
Bears. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for carting away those last copies of Santa and the Three Bears. So yes, I know, we have a friend who is 28 who loved Space Jam as a child. and then saw it again as an adult and said, oh, wait, no.
Well, tell...
Not this.
Tell Iffy. He still defends it. We had to do it this summer as part of the Ifichikude collection.
Well, I cannot speak to that.
I can't wait to hear what he says about the sequel. That'll be coming up on Maximum Film.
I don't know Iffy well enough to tell him that everything he thinks is wrong. That's your job.
I do my best.
Yeah. Why don't we move on to other films? Oh, we have four others to talk about.
Yes.
No Ordinary Man.
Yes.
Is a documentary from Ailing Chinyi and Chase Joint.
Mm-hmm.
They co-directed. It is about the American jazz musician Billy Tipton. Maybe you don't know who that is. He only put out like two albums.
Mm.
And as I said this past week on our segment on KCRW in Los Angeles, he was the kind of guy who lived his entire life trying not to become the subject of a documentary.
Right.
He wanted to become invisible, sort of while simultaneously maintaining his...
Having a career.
His jazz musician career. He was like a regional jazz musician, the kind of guy that toured around playing, you know...
He had a trio.
Theaters and, you know, dance halls and places like that. And again, like I said, he put out two records. He was never famous. He met some famous people.
Yeah.
He worked with some famous people. Later on in his life, I don't know that he maintained that recording career. I think he was...
I think he'd retired.
Retired and devoted himself to his family.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, he'd been married like four or five times, something like that.
Yeah, which the documentary doesn't really go
into that. The documentary only focuses on his last wife.
Yes, and the three sons they
had. And the three sons they adopted. I remember when he died.
Yes.
Because it was 1989,
mm-hmm.
and you could not get away from the tabloids.
Right.
And here were the tabloids. Shocked woman discovers that her late husband was really a woman.
This is the 1989 level of discourse about the media about transgender
people.
Yeah. Tipton was a man who was assigned female at birth.
Yes. Billy Tipton was a transgender man who never told anyone. Not a soul.
Yeah.
And therefore, the day he died was the day his family learned, both his wife and his three sons, that their father was trans. So,
and it only became public because he had collapsed and EMTs.
EMTs came and, so it was on the cover of the Star, National Enquirer.
Yeah. A lot of talk shows.
Within about 2 or 3 months, the family, which I think at the time was really a really brave thing for them to do, they made the talk show rounds. Sally Jesse and, you know, everybody, Oprah, I think, as well.
I believe so, yeah.
Everybody had the family on. And they were, now, someone can correct me if I'm wrong, because all I'm going on is what I...
The clips in the
film. The clips in the film. But they presented a fairly unified front.
Yeah.
You know, he was my husband. I loved him. Now I know this new thing about him.
Yes.
He was my father. I loved him. Now I know this new thing about him. And it's the audiences in the talk shows.
And some of the hosts.
And some of the hosts, too. Displaying, you know, various levels of ignorance, although perhaps well-meaning ignorance, to
hostility.
To actual hostility. And audiences who were really hostile.
Yeah.
There was a book, a biography written about Billy Tipton, with, I mean, I have this weird curiosity about reading it because it just sounds so awful. Even the title is offensive.
Yeah.
And the title is Suits Me.
Yeah. And it sounds like the family sort of participated and then felt betrayed by what the biographer wrote.
Well, they say that in the film.
There's a recording of Billy's wife talking to the biographer.
And, yeah. The biographer came in and basically got all the information from the family and then decided, you know, that they were going to be an investigative journalist.
Right.
And focus instead of focusing on, you know, this man's life, focus on the thing that everybody always focuses on, which used to be the dominant
narrative,
which was, you know, deception.
How did he get away with it?
How did he keep tricking everybody like this his whole life?
Well, and a lot of reporters at the time would have also misgendered him.
Correct. Yes. So the things that we're dealing with today regarding trans folks is the same things we were dealing with back then. Although 30 years ago, the level of education on the part of just about anybody was shockingly lacking and just even more incredulous and more hostile than you might even feel is happening now. And it's still pretty bad sometimes now with people who have bad faith guiding them.
So what the film is doing is on the one hand kind of, you know, allowing the real story of Billy Tipton to be told and allowing him to be understood for who he actually was, and also sort of using the idea of how the press handled Billy's death and the, you know, quote unquote revelation of things, you know, to sort of look at how are these topics discussed in the media and also who decides what our history is and how that history is told and how these important figures are remembered by the people whom they've influenced. So part of what the film is, the filmmakers have this sort of series of auditions where different trans actors, trans masculine actors, will perform segments of Billy's life. You know, Billy goes to audition for his first musical gig. Billy's about to meet Duke Ellington, like different things like that.
Right.
So which allows the film not only to not worry about the fact they don't have footage of any of this stuff, but still kind of bring it to life, but also then they interview these actors about, like, you know, what do these lines mean to you? What does Billy Tipton mean to you? How do you interpret, you know, these life moments that he went through? What about his life speaks to your life? And so it's operating on multiple levels, and they're all really interesting.
I love this movie.
Yeah.
Because as a, you know, queer person, it is the responsibility of every queer person to get as much information and understanding as they can about all the varieties of queer people there are in our family.
Yeah.
And so, as I am not trans, it has been, you know, since childhood, when I first learned of Renee Richards. And started asking questions about what that situation meant.
Right.
You know, and my mother and father, they couldn't explain it to me at all. For the record, Renee Richards was a trans person in the 70s.
A doctor and professional tennis player.
Yeah. And she was big news.
Yes.
All over the place. And the very first time that I had ever encountered the idea that there were trans people in the world.
She was, to the 70s, what Christine Jorgensen had been in the 50s.
Right.
Because, again, like Billy Tipton, a lot of trans people, certainly during those decades and today, and again, don't blame any of them, don't want the spotlight. Do not want to have their private lives picked over by an unfeeling or ignorant media.
And that's one of the reasons, as you just said, why I love this film, because it is yet another step toward queer people in general and trans people specifically taking the story back into their own hands and being the ones who get to tell it rather than having other people tell them who they are.
Right.
Rather than having other people get to decide what the parameters of the dialogue will be. demanding that their experiences be listened to and counted. One of the things that I find so dispiriting about the world right now is I'm old and I remember the past, right? So when I came out in the early 90s, the stuff I was met with by uncomprehending people, by family who didn't get it, friends who didn't get it, and this is just gayness, right?
Yeah.
The same things that I experienced, the, are you sure? Is this a phase? Mm. Do you know your own mind? Have you considered conversion therapy? Have you been to a counselor? What happened to you as a child to make you this way?
Right.
Who harmed you? Mm. Who hurt you and made you gay? Who recruited you and made you gay? Why do you think you should be allowed to do anything, work in any job, be near children?
What's with all these special rights you want?
What are these special rights you want? Can't you just be quiet? Can't you shut up?
Do you have to rub my nose in it?
I don't want it shoved down my throat. Hammering at you constantly.
Yeah.
To remind you that you are the problem. You shouldn't be in a locker room. You shouldn't be in this bathroom. That was a thing.
Yeah.
And once time rolled on and the forces of evil decided, you know what? Gay men and lesbians, we probably can't get too far with them anymore. They got what they wanted for the most part, and now we have to find someone else to attack. Oh, I know. Let's attack the trans people. We're still going to erase the bisexual people and the pansexual people, but let's attack the trans people because we're afraid of them, and we can now use the same old stuff that we used on... Yes. The L and the G.
Our ancient fear tactics.
To go after the T.
Yeah. And we can rely on a lot of L and G people to passively stand by. Stand by and do nothing, or in some cases even sign on to this nonsense.
Yes. So that is a reason why a film like this is important.
Yes.
My favorite moment is... They were asking everybody in the film, if you could have Billy Tipton standing in front of you right now, what would you ask him? And I don't remember now who said this, but the question was, could you ever imagine when you were alive that we would be where we are right now, having these conversations with everybody listening? And everybody looking, you know, could you envision the world as it is now?
Right.
And I love that question because obviously the answer would be no.
No.
You know, you would be looking at the world from the perspective of 1949, 59, 69, 79, 89, where the dominant, you know, way of existing was keep your mouth shut. Don't speak. Invisibilize yourself as much as you can. Assimilate into the world so that you are undetected. And I love that this movie exists. It's called No Ordinary Man.
Yeah.
It's playing right now at the New Art in Los Angeles and other art house theaters across the country. Yes. It'll be streaming pretty soon, though, right?
I would imagine so, yeah. Right? I believe it might be... just New York and LA this weekend, maybe a few other cities. But yeah, it will be expanding and it will be streaming soon enough. So if it's not accessible to you right now, keep an eye out for it. It is really amazing.
We also watched Mama Weed.
Yes.
Which in French, the title is, I think...
La Daronne?
La Daronne?
Daronne.
Daronne. screwing it up. Translated the slang informal version of mother. So mom, ma, mama, you know. Patience Portefeu.
There's a name.
That's her name. Played by Isabelle Huppert.
Mm-hmm.
She's a translator, a French-Arabic translator for the Paris police. She's also in debt, behind on her bills. Her mother's in a nursing home that is about to kick her out because she's Isabelle Huppert is late with the payments. She owes maintenance fees on her apartment to the owner of the building. So she's desperate for money. And she decides one day that she knows a way to get ahead. She has all the resources at her fingertips professionally as an insider, a person who listens in on conversations between Arabic speakers,
right,
and French customers. She's going to get in on the action.
She discovers that she has a personal connection to one of the smugglers.
Yes.
And because almost nobody else at the police station speaks Arabic, she can overhear conversations that are of importance and then mark them as not relevant to the investigation.
Inconsequential. Yeah. Inconsequential to the investigation. So she starts dealing hash in a pretty small way, but plenty enough to get her to the financial place where she wants to be.
Right.
She has all, like I said, she has all the insider knowledge she needs to move it, to hide it, to keep it out of the sight of everybody, not just the police, but the big drug bosses.
From whom she has stolen it.
Yeah. And
and along the way sort of forms these allies, not only with certain members of the Arab-speaking community, Arabic-speaking community, sorry, but also her landlady. Huppert's character is the one last non-Chinese person living in the building.
Yeah.
But once she sort of forms a friendship with the landlady, there's this kind of understanding of like, this is what we do to survive in France. There's a lot of looking the other way. There's some money laundering going on. And it becomes this way of people who have been disenfranchised by, you know, the system to help each other to work, you know, on the outer edges of that system so they can all survive.
And it's fine.
Yeah. It's not like a full-on sort of wacky Fun with Dick and Jane kind of caper.
Right.
But it also, I don't think, is saying nearly as much about non-white people in France as it thinks
right.
It does.
Yeah. There's a lot of female solidarity.
Yes.
In the film.
Yes.
And Isabelle Huppert is...
Isabelle Huppert.
When is she not great?
She's even good in Heaven's Gate.
In a film, when is she not great?
Did you recognize Hippolyte Giraudoux, who plays her boyfriend on the police force?
No. Who?
He's the dad in A Christmas Story.
A Christmas Tale?
Yes, sorry.
You mean?
Yes, A Christmas Tale.
A Christmas Story is an American film
is,
that
right,
gets shown
right,
on
right,
TNT.
Right. Not that one. Right. Yes. He's
Arnaud Desplechin's A Christmas Tale.
Yes.
The French film.
He plays Deneuve's husband in that film.
All right. This is going to play in art house theaters because it is in French and because it stars Isabelle Huppert. She is going to drive all the box office to this film.
Basically.
It is not demanding filmmaking. It is a caper. And it's about a story where women work the system in a world where the system has failed.
Is working against them.
Yeah.
Real quick, sorry, correction. He plays Anne Consigny's husband in Conte de Noël.
Great.
Yeah, it's fine.
It is a film about a white woman getting away with all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe... her colleagues of color who get away with things, but not as much as she does. Here's the deal. I'm not French. I don't know.
If there are subtleties here that are beyond our ken, that's certainly a possibility.
Our ken.
Yes.
Beyond our understanding of French culture, beyond our understanding of the nuances of the language and what we were given as subtitles, beyond our understanding of French racism and the anti-Muslim way of life that is, you know,
yeah,
unfortunately happening there. And it kind of seems like the film wants it both ways. It wants to be the caper that you don't have to think too much about and occasionally
delve into real issues.
Delve into the realistic life of people who are on the margins.
Yeah.
I don't think it is successful in either of them entirely. Having said that, it's pretty funny from time to time because she is so great.
Yeah. If you just want to watch Isabelle Huppert, that's what you get.
You learn things about her character, why she's been motivated to do this, how she grew up.
Yeah.
Also, a little bit outside the law herself sometimes as a child. Mm. So, you know, there's a character here that you can
follow,
pay attention to, enjoy. It's okay. She's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. What are we doing?
You tell me.
Her socialist smile?
Sure, why not?
Yeah.
So.
Knock.
Stop. Who's there?
Helen Keller.
Helen Keller who?
I don't even know what the punchline would be.
I'm not even sure.
All I know is that when I was a little kid, here's everything I learned about Helen Keller.
Yes.
Born, unable to see, unable to hear. Ann Sullivan comes along, teaches her to read, write, and to speak.
Yeah.
They make a movie about it with Patty Duke and Anne Bancroft.
Right.
I remember checking out a book about her from my elementary school library. It was a kid's book, like from Scholastic.
Right.
Very simple. You know, she learned these things and then she spent her life
helping other
blind yeah. people and deaf people, you know, inspiring everyone that she met.
The end.
The end. And then when you're done reading that Scholastic book and knowing that the miracle worker exists, and after you've heard every third grade Helen Keller joke that is told by other third graders to you, you never think about Helen Keller again. And so here comes this documentary called Her Socialist Smile, where you learn not only was Helen Keller probably the most influential civilian woman in the United States in the early part of the 20th century, but she was a total communist.
Oh, yeah. Hardcore, IWW, wobbly, all the full nine yards. She was totally a hard left socialist.
She was, all of her writing,
and shared this with the world, like yeah. gave speeches, wrote articles.
And she was really popular doing it for a time.
Yes. And then
until World War One. And they started sort of suppressing her.
Well, and everybody else.
As much as they could.
Yeah.
She seemed charmed, though, in this way where she had a lot of resources. Mm-hmm. Like, she came from a wealthy family.
Right.
And so, short of arresting her, they couldn't really stop her from traveling around and speaking or her writing work.
Yeah, you can't send the Pinkertons to crack Helen Keller's skull.
Right.
Like, you have to sort of let her have her podium and do her thing. And she used that very cannily, I think, her privilege as a wealthy woman and as a celebrity to try to sort of foment this workers' revolution.
Yeah.
And then, history kind of never tells you that part of the Helen Keller story. It didn't tell me anyway, because, same deal. Dumb jokes, miracle worker, the end. Like that, yeah. You know. And so this was a very revealing film.
So here's the thing about it, though. It's from John Gianvito, mm-hmm. and he's a political documentary filmmaker.
That scans.
And the archival material about Helen Keller, a lot of it is gone.
Yeah.
She experienced a fire in her home.
During her life.
And it wiped out, like, everything she owned. Everything she wrote. Everything. What was left after her death was being housed in a foundation, a Helen Keller Institute.
Mm-hmm. In New York City.
In New York City. In a building that was so close to the World Trade Center that on 9/11, that building caught debris, caught fire, and the rest of her archives gone.
Yes.
There's still some left in, you know, existing in the world, but talk about having your stuff just erased.
Yeah. Keep a second copy, folks.
So what you get in this documentary is other ways of telling you this stuff.
Yes.
It is extremely quiet, with the exception of one Slovenian punk band playing a song in the middle of the movie. It just jolts you out of the quiet.
Yeah.
And then it goes back to being quiet.
I thought it was a Clash song I didn't know.
But what you get is, visually, lots of detailed shots of nature, like close-ups of leaves and flowers and grass and insects
rivers.
And rivers and narration from a poet.
Carolyn Forché.
Thank you. And then they do this really interesting thing. Rather than have Carolyn Forché reading the text of Helen Keller's writings and speeches, they give you big blocks of this text on a black screen and enough time to read it silently to yourself. So I have one of those blocks of text. And I read a little bit of it on KCRW last week, and they let it all go.
Oh, wow.
Like, they didn't edit any of it. And it was, and I was trying to be brief, and I thought, they're still going to chop this down to like two sentences, but they didn't. But so I'm going to read you the whole thing.
Okay.
Here we go. This is something that she wrote.
This is one text, one screen of text in this film.
Let us try to understand poverty. What is the cause of it? Simply this. That the land, the machinery, the means of life belong to the few, while the many are born and lived with nothing that they can call their own, except their hands and their brains. They live by selling their hands and their brains to the few, and all the work they do makes the rich more rich and gains for the workers less than a livelihood. The ownership of the world by a small class is the main cause of poverty. Strange that we could not see it before, and that when we did see it, we accepted it in blind contentment. Our blind guides consoled us by saying that there was so much charity, and that the rich were generous and gave to the poor. We now see that what the rich give is only a small part of the money that is made for them by the labor of the poor. They never stop to think that if the workers received an equitable share of their product, there would be no rich. There would be little need of philanthropy. Charity covers a multitude of sins and does something worse than that. It covers the facts so that they cannot be seen. It covers the facts that the property of the few is made by the labor of the many. The rich are willing to do everything but the poor. The rich are willing to do everything for the poor, but get off their backs. Our blind leaders used often to blame the poor for their poverty. They declared that the workers did not work enough. They were not thrifty enough. They squandered their wages. Now we stop and think. We remember that if the workers do not work enough, they do all the work that is done. They make every house that stands, every yard of cloth, every loaf of bread, and that all we have we owe to them. If the worker is not thrifty, does not save, it is as often as not because a large part of what he produces goes to someone else, and someone else does the saving. If one man has without producing, it is only because another man produces without having. And that is the trouble in a nutshell.
the thing
so
that Barry,
what's up, Helen Keller?
Yeah, believe me, so much of what she has to say still feels so horribly relevant in 2021.
Yeah,
a thing to bear in mind here is that if blind or deaf people want to enjoy this film, I don't know how it's set up right now in terms of audio description and subtitling, because there are stretches of the film where it's beautiful images of nature and the voiceover is reading Keller's work, and then other parts where it's just the text on screen with nothing to listen to. And so given that Keller herself was deaf and blind, and I'm sure she has, there are a lot of people who are deaf and blind who are interested in any kind of new Helen Keller related media, it's important to know that this movie may or may not be accommodating to their enjoyment of it.
So you can see this. It's called Her Socialist Smile.
Yes.
You can see it in really select art house theaters. I know there's, it's playing at one theater, I think, in Los Angeles right now. But you can also stream it.
Ah.
So just go Google that. If you have the internet, you can virtual cinema this one.
Nice.
And then finally, Roadrunner.
Yes.
The documentary about Anthony Bourdain.
Yes.
This is the sad one. You know?
Yeah, it's weird. I didn't really know that much about him. Like,
yeah.
I remember when he died. I remember there was a lot of, you know, the reading about it and how so many people were so upset about it.
Shocking. Like, yes. He's 61 years old.
Yes. I mean, any time that you know, someone takes their own life, it obviously reverberates and is a great shock to a great many people. But I wasn't really familiar with his career, his work. And so this movie was illuminating in that respect. And I think it also provides a sense of, you know, who he was when the cameras weren't on.
Yeah. I knew Anthony Bourdain just from TV. Mm-hmm. I had never read his books. I knew that he, In a way, he, jump-started in the culture, and I could be mistaken about this, but in my mind, he jump-started in the culture the idea of the bad boy chef.
Mm.
And he even says at one point, and it's in the trailer too, he goes, other TV chefs are so warm and cuddly, and I'm the antidote to that. And I never thought of him as... Because I didn't read the books, I only watched him, you know, on the travel shows. I thought, well, you know, you're a rakish, rough and tumble guy, I guess, but I don't think of you as a, you know, a bad boy.
Right.
And quite frankly, I never saw him on TV teaching me anything how to cook, so I always went for the warm and cuddly ones. You know, I like to wake up on Saturday morning and watch Ida Garten, and so that's. My experience of him was the travel shows.
Sure.
And what I liked about the travel shows was exactly what you see here, that he did not shy away from the troubling aspect of culinary colonial tourism.
Right.
And how other places have been, you know, ravaged for the sake of Western
expansion
needs, desires. So he was, you know, he may have been a difficult person, but he did important work, and the film gives him his due on that, and it does so without a lot of the butt kissiness.
Mm.
They don't talk to a lot of famous people. In fact, the two most well-known people they talk to, interview-wise, or three, I guess, would be John Lurie, the musician, David Chang, the chef, and David Cho, the artist.
Yeah.
And everybody else were people that he, you know, his producers, his crew, his second wife, you know, various friends. A couple other chefs. And so you get a very, you know, straightforward account of his life. It's not, in praise of all the time. And everyone on camera is willing to talk about the problems that he had. He was, and he himself, he talks about it. He was a drug addict.
And someone who, even after, you know, rehab, had an addictive personality in yes. various ways. Yeah, it's...
And who, and toward the end, began to sort of spiral
yeah.
In many ways that disturbed his colleagues. You know, he began to fire people. And people didn't quite understand where they stood anymore with him.
I have seen some people try and say that the movie is sort of demonizing Aja Argento and okay. their relationship. And, you know, I think if anything, it sort of comes off as a symptom of other problems in his life. And so it's like if he did start firing, you know, members of the crew because she was directing or whatever, it didn't seem so much as like, oh, she's this, you know, terrible presence. It's just that he was, it was that relationship, it was part of his sort of losing ground in a lot of other ways.
He was, according to the film, he was sort yeah. of consumed with her by the end. And what makes a person take their life? I don't know.
Yeah. And they certainly don't try to concretely answer.
I watch films like this. Going back a few years, the film Christine, we watched. Mm-hmm. You're constantly left with the mystery. Yeah. You know, you and I have had friends in our life who yes. have killed themselves.
Yes.
And sometimes you have a feeling that that person, you know, needs help that you can't give them. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes it's an absolute shock because they were so closed off and not talking to you at all about it. So watching this movie doesn't give me any more insight into why, you know, that moment you decide, you know, what is that moment? Why then what happened? You know, and you don't get to know. But what it does do is sort of in a very kind, empathy-driven way, make a statement about this man and the good he gave to the world and how much people loved him. If this is subject matter that is too, you know, tough to deal with, then don't watch it.
No.
And if it weren't for the fact that it was my job, maybe I would have avoided it
sure.
for a while myself. You know, it's been a rough year and a half.
No, for sure. I want to touch on real quick about some of the sort of ethical questions being raised by the documentary.
The quotes?
Yes. Just because I think it's worth having the conversation. I don't have a firm take right. on this.
Yeah.
But after the release, Morgan Neville, the director, who's an acclaimed documentarian, he did 20 Feet from Stardom and Best of Enemies and Won't You Be My Neighbor, said that basically there were some things that they had that Bourdain had written but had never spoken aloud, and they basically worked with the company to create an AI of Bourdain's voice so they could have him saying these things that he had written, that he had expressed,
okay.
but had just never said aloud before. And so people immediately sort of hopped on that as like, what are you doing? And he apparently gave a quote saying that he had checked with Bourdain's widow, and she yeah. immediately responded, no, you did not, and I certainly would not have okayed that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that is a whole separate issue, I think.
All right.
The idea of using AI to recreate someone's voice and have that voice say a thing that the person himself had written, that were yes. his words.
Yes.
I feel falls into something of a gray area.
I don't know what I think about that.
And I don't have a final take on this. And
Mostly because I've never encountered it until just now.
Well, it's new. And I want to see what
this exact moment.
I will be curious to see what the conversation is about. But I mean, I remember when The Thin Blue Line came out.
Right.
And people were appalled.
Yes.
That he was recreating.
Errol Morris. Yes.
Was recreating things.
Yes.
That he was, you know, like not.
But just, you knew it was a recreation yes. when you watched it.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. But still, there were like old hardline documentary people were like
appalled. You don't do this.
Yeah. Yeah. And now, of course, everybody doesn't. It's just, it's a common thing. You know, you, now you put animation in a documentary.
Correct.
To depict something visually. So, like, you know, it's an ever-evolving way of making films. And, you know, I will be fascinated to see what the conversation around this practice is. And obviously, you know, in a world of deep fakes and whatnot, it can be used, you know, in a very detrimental way. But I think in this particular case, in which the person's actual words are being vocalized, I will at least chalk it up to a gray area for right now.
Yeah, I have no answer for this.
No, that's fine.
Part of me is thinking, well, okay, well, he wrote it.
Exactly.
But why not just let someone read what he wrote?
Well, there is that. Or get an actor who sounds like...
Why would
like
you need to go to the... I don't understand.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the thing that people are going to be talking about around this movie, I think. I don't know if it's going to dominate the conversation, but it is going to be part of it. I'll be interested to see what other documentarians have to say about it.
We got some letters.
Yes.
How would you like me to read them to you?
With your mouth.
All right. Where are my glasses? Here they are. Dalen says, I love hearing all of your thoughts and making this somehow unintentionally themed to my alternate universe husband, David Harbour. I appreciate all of the Marvel thoughts, even though I'm definitely more on the Alonzo side of things than Dave. The next one is going to be Shang-Chi in December.
Shang-Chi.
Yes. In September. And I cannot wait to see Thor, Love, and Thunder, simply for all of the possible Taika Waititi 80s aesthetic insanity. Which is the next Marvel project you're the most interested to see? Whatever the next one is, I guess. And I got to say something, going back to Black Widow. This might sound wild to people who have listened to me talk about my, you know, only in the moment interest in Marvel films, but part of me feels like I have to watch Black Widow again.
Huh. Why is that?
I don't know. I'm just this nagging feeling like I didn't give it a fair shake.
Okay.
And I haven't sorted out what I... It's just in my gut. Okay. This thing like, I don't know, you might have, you know, taken too dim a view of it just because it felt like the re-cranking up of an assembly line.
Ah, fair enough.
You know, it is incumbent upon us as film critics to take what we are given and make sense of it.
Sure.
And not simply to dismiss it as product, even though its creators often may be thinking of it simply as product. We still have to figure out why it's here.
Right.
And, you know, coming off a good long break from Marvel movies, having one come along struck all those old feelings in me again. Those old feelings of, okay, here's an object that I have been given for entertainment's sake.
Right.
It will take me 2 hours and 15 minutes to consume this object. I'll probably have a pretty good time doing that. Then I never have to think about it again because, in spite of the fact that these are technological wonders, they say nothing to me about my life. And therefore, I don't have to pay a whole lot of attention to my job regarding these films. And I think I might need to go back and do that. Give this one another shake.
I think there is something to be said, and whether or not you think this is a thing that's worth doing or not, obviously.
But I'm not going to watch Space Jam 2 because screw it.
No, for God's sake. I think one of the things that I find really interesting about the Marvel movies, and to some extent the DC television shows, is their attempt to sort of create a unified world in the way that comic books have. You know, in the, you have this overarching story that carries through all these different characters and places and details that nonetheless all sort of tie in together in one way or another. And that's a thing that, you know, Marvel in the 60s and then DC later kind of like figured out a way to do and make it cohesive and make it all over the map. And then, you know, the film adaptations and the TV adaptations really shied away from, and they really wanted everything to be sort of discreet and self-contained, and they were sort of afraid of blowing it out into this big world, which is what the Marvel movies are doing. And that there is a fairly consistent level of quality to these films. Yes, obviously some of them are better than others. And the fact that they have, you know, baked in this kind of unified theory of you know, what the universe is impressive. And given how clumsy DC's big screen version attempts to do the same have been, it's obviously not that easy where everybody would do it.
Right.
So, just that.
Andrew says, I'm a big fan of animation, and I was excited to see that the Criterion Channel is doing a July collection focused on art house animation.
Yes.
Looking through the collection made me curious about your thoughts on animation as a medium, and also made me think about Pixar's Soul once again. In general, I find animation in America, at least what I've seen, to be criminally underutilized. However, films like Undone, Into the Spider-Verse, and Soul each take advantage of the medium to convey different messages, feelings, and visuals in a way that live action could not. I'm wondering if you think there's hope for more adult-focused, targeted animation that doesn't just recreate the sitcom format. I look forward to hearing your answers, and if there are any films in that art house animation collection that you would recommend in particular.
Interesting question. I think that America's attitudes about animated films have always been a bit retrograde compared to other countries. I think in France and Japan, to name a couple, like, there's no knee-jerk decision that, like, oh, animation, it's for kids, it's for the family, you know.
It's, you know, early on, Disney's short animated
Steamboat Willie
films before, you know, that were in theaters that would play before the feature.
Short subjects.
The Looney Tunes, same deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were made with an everybody audience in mind, adults and kids. And
also,
you know,
most movies were at that point too.
Yes.
Because of the production code.
So with the advent of, you know, Saturday morning programming, you then found, you know, Bugs Bunny and all those characters
right.
on Saturday morning aimed directly at children. And the idea of this medium being something for everyone became more and more child-focused, to the point where now we look at animation for adults and think, oh, wow, that's unusual. But as you say, it's not been like that in other countries.
Certainly not.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I think that, and again, this kind of ties into the Marvel thing. I think that there are people who have reached a certain age and a certain level of power in the industry who are maybe saying, no, look, this is actually valid, and it's not just this dumb disposable thing for little kids that,
right.
that that we could actually take this seriously. We could actually pitch this to a broader audience, you know, that you have R-rated superhero movies now.
Right.
Is something that in an earlier era would have been unthinkable. So I think certainly there is a possibility for more adult animation. Again, we have it now, but so much of it is coming from, you know, outside of the U.S. Looking at the list, there's some great stuff here. I have still not seen Belladonna of Sadness, but I've heard great things.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic Planet is not totally my jam, but I understand why it's important.
It's cool.
Yeah, and it's worth a look. I have not seen Watership Down or The Plague Dogs.
I've seen Watership Down.
Intense, I know.
It'll put you through the ringer.
Yeah.
A Town Called Panic.
Well, I haven't gotten there yet.
Is wild.
Yeah, I absolutely right. watch A Town Called Panic.
Yeah.
The Svankmajer films are interesting. He's, I think, he's a specific kind of artist in the way that, like, you look at a Guy Madden movie and you're like, well, that nobody else.
No one
this
else
is
does
a Guy
that,
Madden movie.
Like the,
this
like
is a
does.
Jan Svankmajer
right.
movie. Millennium Actress, did we do that as a club meeting? Is that the one we did?
Yes, and it was a bad decision, not because it's a bad film,
no,
but because OK Club Meeting is something that
it's text based.
It's we are chatting and having to read, and it's
yeah. We figured out you couldn't do subtitles and a text at the same yeah. time. But Millennium Actress is a beautiful film. Mind Game I just saw for the first time because one of the listeners at Maximum Film who was picked at random, who was part of Max Fun Drive, got to pick a film for us to review, and they chose Mind Game. And it's a freak out, but in a really good way. You're a big Paprika fan, I know.
Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah. Persepolis is great. Waltz with Bashir is great. They're both sort of like practically documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
Town Called Panic, brilliant. I'm not the biggest fan of Chico and Rita, but I'm in the minority on that one. It's Such a Beautiful Day is haunting. I'm a big fan of Don Hertzfeld. And Tower, also practically a documentary about the University of Texas shooting in the 60s. Of the ones that I've seen, those are all really amazing. And, you know, the Criterion Channel generally knows what they're doing. So if somebody curated this in an adult animation segment, they're probably all good.
Yeah, pretty much. That's it. We're done. We have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/ linoleum knife. You go there, you look at the amounts of money that you can use from your own bank account to subscribe to various other podcasts that we provide. We are selling content.
Yes.
Would you like to buy it? Thank you. If you would. If you can't, we understand that too. If you don't want to hear any more of us, or if you think that free is the only way
we are
worth your time, we also understand that.
Yes. Speaking of Patreon, if you would like to hear Dave and me discussing the Hallmark Christmas in July premiere Crashing Through the Snow with our friends Bibbs and Whitney at the Critically Acclaimed podcast, you will need to join the Critically Acclaimed Patreon.
A warning right now, I use adult language.
Yes, very un-Hallmark language. And then next month, if you are an LKTV subscriber, you will get to hear another conversation that we have with Bibbs and Whitney about another Hallmark movie that is premiering in August. So that's going to be fun.
Will it?
It will.
Fine.
You said you were looking forward to this one. It's the return of
Christmas Murder Bakery.
Christmas Murder Bakery, exactly. patreon.com/ critically acclaimed is where that episode lives. And if you would like to hear us on it, you'll need to join up. Is that it? Are we done?
You're done. That's
We're
it.
Done. All right. Well, listen, thanks everybody for listening. Check out our friends on the internet, critically acclaimed, like I said. The Schmoes Know, Sewers of Paris.
I got to say, I liked it better when you were going to have that thing where you were like, I want to talk about one in depth for
a
minute.
Fine.
And I liked that idea. What was the one? You did one and then you were like, no, this is too hard.
It is too hard.
What was the one you did?
I talked about Critically Acclaimed before.
All right, fine.
This week, All Things Cozy.
And they're currently on a bit of a...
They're on a summer break, but you can catch up on episodes if you haven't been listening.
Yeah.
Matt and Jillian do a...
We adore them.
Soothing balm of a podcast
that
explores everything that is warm and fuzzy and cozy.
And sometimes we are lucky and get to be guests.
Yes.
Occasionally.
So if you want to hear more of us and not pay for our Patreon...
They review candles.
They review candles. They talk about, sunsets and mystery novels and cats. So it's quite lovely. So, yes, All Things Cozy. Go check them out. That's my one this week.
Pick one. Be nice about it.
You can subscribe to this show at Apple Podcasts. And if you leave us a 5-star review there, we will read it on the air. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Spotify and Google Play and Amazon Music and Stitcher Radio, thelounge.com, CastBox, Podbean. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Check him out at bandcamp.com/BLEU. And, of course, you can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We'll be back next time with more. Until then,
goodbye.